Welcome back, everybody, to the Quill and Query podcast. My name is Brandon Hall. As always, I'm joined today by my wonderful co-host, Ash. Ash, how are you doing today?
I've survived the Tuesday, so we can give a round of applause to that. How are you, Brandon?
Always love to hear that. I'm going to go with the same. I'm doing good to survive the Tuesday, but I'm doing really good because we have another very special guest here on Quill and Query, so I won't take up too much of the intro space here. Jordan, why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself to everyone tuning in?
Okay. Well, hey, everyone. Thank you to Brandon and Ash for having me. I'm JN or Jordan Kindig. I'm just realizing I did not put JN on my little name thing, but that. That is what I publish under. I'm an epic dark fantasy writer.
Very cool. Well, we're excited to talk all things books and writing with you today. But before we start throwing you all of the hard questions, we like to do a little bit of a icebreaker question. So I guess we just like to check in and see, is there anything you're currently reading, or what are you currently up to in your day-to-day besides writing?
Day-to-day besides writing, I am in my last semester of grad school. So okay. I've been very like, go for that lately. I'm doing the English masters, and just one of the things we have to do is create a reading list for an oral comprehensive exam. Everything I've studied, every class I've taken is potentially up for grabs on this exam. So just being able to walk down memory lane and see like what I've had to read in classes past has been really fascinating. So I'm about to really start digging deep into that. But in terms of reading, I actually finished listening to Lapvona by Otessa Moshfegh today.
How was that?
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm still processing.
I've heard great things.
Yes, I keep, this might be a slight spoiler, but I think, Ash, I think you know this, I recently finished The Starving Saints by Caitlin Starling. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so going from that and finishing another book I was currently reading into Lapvona, I keep picking books about cannibalism, and I'm not trying to do it on purpose. But yeah, that's really only like maybe 20% of all the craziness that happens in Lapvona. It was my first Moshfegh book, but I enjoyed it.
It's the season. It's the season for cannibalism, if I can say. So it's an appropriate time. But I can see why. I haven't read it, and it's on my forever and never ending TBR. But I'm glad you seem to like it.
It sounds like there's a subgenre I'm missing out on over here.
Medieval horror. It's been really
It's fun.
Yeah, I'll need to brush up on the cannibalism fantasy books.
Yeah.
Great place to start.
Well, glad to hear school is going well. Always admire everyone who can go through that while also maintaining, you know, a writing career. It's not easy, I imagine, to juggle both of those things, but sorry, my document is loading. Okay, so I guess with that out of the way, we can go ahead and get into the interview questions, talk a little bit about your books and your writing process. But I think what we can start with is, for anyone who doesn't know you, is not familiar with any of your published books, tell us a little bit about you and what you write. I know in the intro you said dark fantasy seems to be your focus, but let's go into that a little bit more. What can people expect when they pick up a JN Kindig book?
Yeah. So I have two titles out right now. I know we're video live as well, so I just like having show and tell kind of thing.
So go for it.
My debut was The Nightmare Novellas. I know it's flipped, but this is her. It's, again, dark epic fantasy. It's actually a collection of six novellas instead of one long form piece. They all tell one cohesive story, but I chose to do novellas, just to challenge myself, because I can overwrite really easily, and I wanted to try to make myself do something a little shorter. Did I completely succeed? I don't know. That's up for the readers to decide, but it is about these two nightmare hunters. They are blessed by the gods to hunt dangerous ghosts and spirits, but they get distracted from this mission. One of them falls in love, has to decide if he wants to pursue this relationship, because if he does, he'll have to kind of turn his back on, you know, this order he's trained to be a part of his entire life. And then our second main character, because it's a point of view for each one, our second main character, she finds this ancient evil that people thought was defeated a long time ago underneath her family's palace, and she has to exorcise it before it gets out, anyone else finds out about it, and can hurt anyone else. And I don't know, that one's just a lot of fun. And then Breathing Ice Like Fire is my second one. This was actually part of an anthology I was invited to be a part of, and then I just published it on its own. The anthology, I believe, has been pulled from print now, so this is the only way you can get it. But it is about this prince. His father passes away and he's next in line for the throne, and tradition in his kingdom says that he has to have a wife to take the throne. He has no interest in doing that. So he goes to fight this dragon, wants to slay this dragon, but during the fight wounds it to the point where it transforms into a woman. She was cursed to take that shape, and his men come in, find both of them severely hurt, take them both back to the palace, and the prince is the only one who knows her secret. And things go from there.
Very cool. Well, sounds like you have a couple of options for people to pick up. Just a side note, I think the covers you have, especially the one for the Nightmare Novellas, are really gorgeous. I can't stop checking them out. I want to get the Nightmare Novellas just to put on my shelf because I think it looks great.
I know, I do too.
Oh, that's so sweet. I do have to say, it's like when you tell a girl you like her dress and it has pockets. I feel like I'll be able to do it. This was a pre-made cover.
Oh, really?
Whoa.
Mm-hmm.
That's really
I never would have guessed.
Arts Kandari, I think is how you pronounce it. But yeah, mm-hmm. It was just a pre-made cover. I happened to see it on their website, and one of my characters has a sword called Peacebringer. And so seeing the sword on the cover, I was like, that's perfect. I have to get that one.
I know, I've got it on my Kindle, but it's like the Kindle where the colors don't show. So I'm the same as Brandon. I'm like, I need to actually get the physical copy and just put it up somewhere.
I don't know if this is like true representation of what's actually in the book, but it feels like a great book to have on the shelf for like spooky season and mm-hmm. fall.
I do want it to have that kind of spooky season vibe because it's ghosts and monsters. I kind of lean into that as much as I can because I like incorporating a lot of horror elements into my writing. Also same thing with gothic literature. Mm-hmm. And I might be a little biased, but I absolutely think it's a good spooky season read.
I agree. Excuse me.
Very cool. Well, Ash, I'll let you go ahead and ask the next question that we got on the list.
Yeah. So obviously you're a writer and obviously you're getting your master's in English, which a huge feat unto itself. But can you tell us a little bit more about like what writers and what authors have inspired you and have guided you since you've begun the process of writing and being an author?
Yeah, Leigh Bardugo is the biggest one, you know, Shadow and Bone, Six of Crows, Ninth House. I love, particularly in Shadow and Bone, how she like riffs on this idea of light versus dark. I think that's something I've always found very, very fascinating. And I was lucky enough to take a class on British Gothic literature and just seeing how, even, you know, back in the 1700s, 1800s, how that duality has been used throughout magical realism, speculative fiction, so on, has just always really fascinated me. So she's a great author for that. Sylvia Moreno Garcia, she wrote Mexican Gothic, which is another one of my favorite books. That one I could probably talk about for hours because I actually wrote a paper on it for school.
Oh, but excellent.
The way she brings in, again, those common Gothic tropes and kind of twists it to make something new, I think is really exciting. Mary Shelley, Frankenstein, I loved reading that. And Andrzej Sapkowski with The Witcher, that actually directly inspired the Nightmare Novellas as well.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah. I think you used that a lot, like when I saw you were posting, you know, about, it was either in the lead up to the Nightmare Novellas or something, but there was like comparisons to The Witcher. And as soon as you said that, I was like, go to Herbert, so good. I'm ready for it.
Definitely probably the lead up. I have not been on top of my marketing game very much lately, so... But yeah, that is my number one comp title for the Nightmare Novellas.
Well, we know you're juggling school and writing, so I imagine your process is going to be pretty interesting in this next question. But what does a typical writing day look like for you? You know, having to juggle both of those things, and I'm sure you're doing a lot of writing for school as well. Mm-hmm. How do you make sure you're, giving the right amount of attention to your writing, and what does your process look like having to do both of those things?
Yeah, that's, I go through phases with it because I work full time as well. And so typically whenever I'm able to sit down and write, it's in like, maybe I have 30 minutes on my lunch break if I've finished my readings for class, or maybe I can do an hour or two each night. on the weeknights, but I get really protective over my weekends too, especially my Sunday afternoons, because like after church, my husband and I will just go to a coffee shop and sit and camp out. And that's typically when I get a lot of work done. I'm definitely more, wait, where was I going with that? Really just whenever I can make the time for it. I have a lot of writing that I do like on the notes app on my phone. I have a lot of sticky notes with like my workplace letterhead that where an idea just came to me in between like pulling a report or writing an email, and I have to scribble that down really quick. So I feel like a magpie, like, but instead of shiny things, pulling in all these ideas that I had like throughout the day whenever I finally get to sit down and write.
Yeah. And, I think that's go ahead, Brandon.
Oh, I was just going to say, and one aspect I forgot to touch on was, would you consider yourself more of a plotter or a pantser?
Ooh, plotter. But it varies from project to project. And I've also noticed in the whatever form of project I'm working on as well, because for school, I've taken a lot of fiction writing courses. And so if it's like a flash fiction piece or a short story, I can let myself be much more go with the flow. I can kind of just have a general, very general like, vibe. Or just like an idea, and I don't necessarily have to know everything that happens. I can just sit down and write. But if it's something long form, because especially with the Nightmare novellas, that's going to be part of a right now plan to be 5-book saga that I'm working on, I have to plot so much more because I love getting to foreshadow things. I like dropping in Easter eggs. There's a couple in here that I don't think are going to be relevant for a few books, and I'm very excited for people to pick up on that. It's actually right out of frame. I have a double-sided whiteboard on wheels that I do my timeline on. And maybe I can pull it in frame for a second. Hang on.
You should. Yeah, go ahead. I was going to say that's like when I think of you as a writer. Yeah, when I think of you as a writer, I think of the whiteboard because it's been in some posts before. And it actually inspired me to get mine. But I don't have a space big enough for the rolly double-sided. Yeah. So this is so cool.
Getting our house absolutely made it like possible for me to get this because back when we had our apartment, this would not have fit anywhere.
Yeah.
I feel like I need to lean into this more and maybe, that's the spoiler side.
we can blur it out in post. Yeah. So there's no spoilers.
So the timeline's on the other side, but it would have been quite a hassle to flip it. But yes, I'm a very visual person. Like even, like I said, when we had our apartment, we had kind of a long hallway in it. And so I would just, because I did this with academic papers too, I would just get post-it notes and write stuff on there and stick it on the wall. So again, long form stuff, I just have to be very detail oriented. So I huge respect to pantsers. I could not do it. I can't even fathom of how y'all can.
Yeah, I think we're pretty much both plotters. It's nice to just have like that there. And if you end up riffing off of it in a way that you haven't planned to, that's good too. But I went from like straight pantsing to being like a full like thousands of words per chapter outliner for that exact reason. I just for the same reason you were saying is just like, oh, I would like to Easter egg things to be done later. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, like someone says something here that might be relevant later, but if I don't write it down, it's like absolutely never gonna stick in my head.
Yeah, and Easter eggs, like that's something I love finding in books and series that I read. So it's something I want to be able to turn around and do for my readers as well.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, quick side note. I always have like great respect for anyone who can take their lunch break and write in those short 30 minutes. I cannot get into my writing mindset on like a work break, no matter how much I try. Or like if I have just a spare 30 minutes, the only thing I'm thinking about is how many minutes are left. I can't sit down and like get into the
writing headspace. Normally I found, cause I get an hour for my lunch break, but I typically try to get out of my office and take a walk too. Cause there's just a lot of really cute, like historic houses near my workplace. And, especially now they all have really good Halloween decorations. So I just like walking around and seeing those. But I've found that if I want to be successful writing on my lunch break, I need to have been like thinking about it in the back of my mind up until my lunch break. Not to say that I don't work, because I do. I feel like I need to give that caveat
for any employers watching.
But yes, it's because, you know, I'm sure y'all both get it. Some days you just wake up and the story is just so in your head much more than it normally is. Those are the best lunch break days for me.
Gotcha. Yeah, maybe I should try that approach, just like if I've been thinking about it throughout the day, going in with that mindset. But yeah, it's just something I've never been able to do.
Yeah. Speaking of like, you know, your day-to-day, and you mentioned the whiteboard, are there any other tools that you use when you're writing? Do you use something like Scrivener, or is it a doc, or like what extra things do you pull in to make the writing happen for you?
So I use Scrivener and Google Docs. Scrivener is for the actual drafting process, because I just love the side-by-side view. That was like the thing that made me pull the trigger on downloading Scrivener. But for Google Docs, I use that mostly for planning and outlining, because I like to be able to share outlines with my critique partner and get her feedback on certain things before I really go full tilt into a draft. But one thing I meant to bring it up when we were talking about plotting, but because I like to be so detail oriented with certain projects, I will create what's called an encyclopedia on Google Docs ever since they added in the tab feature. And I think my document for the Rui Svet Saga, which is what the Nightmare Novellas is part of, I think I have like 22 different subtabs on there just for like characters and places and deities and the magic system. And so I don't know why I have to do that in Google Docs. I think I just like the portability and the accessibility of that, because Scrivener, I have to take my laptop with me, but Google Docs, like, I can pull it up on my phone if I'm forgetting about something.
Yeah, I've also found that Scrivener can be like a little tedious with like format and stuff too, which is good when you're drafting, but like, yeah, when you just want to get a thought down or like include something or reference back, I've kind of found the same. I'm trying to keep all of mine in Scrivener because I do like it so much, especially the side-by-side, but now you've maybe driven me to try out the Google Docs, or it's good good advice.
The tabs feature is definitely a game changer. It's it's really nice.
Yeah,
if they ever implement some kind of side-by-side thing in Google Docs, Scrivener I think will have a lot of competition for me personally.
Yeah, that's true too. I would agree.
We got a comment from Mandy. This is pretty much how I feel when I sit down to write, but she says she needs medieval tavern music, a drink, the stars to align, and a snack. Yeah, and that's
the medieval much my tavern, checklist. The medieval tavern ambience is, I was actually telling this, talking about this with my husband the other day. I can tell what stage of like locked in I am on a project based on what I'm listening to in the background. So if I'm just, kind of developing it, I can listen to music with words, but when I start like outlining or drafting, it can be classical medieval tavern ambience, that kind of thing. But there was a video, because I was on deadline these last few weeks, and so I was really crunching into it. There was this hour-long video I got recommended, and it was just like divinity, grim, dark, orchestral throat singing. I think it's meant for like Warhammer people. There were a lot of people talking about Warhammer in the comments, and I'm not familiar with that.
Oh, interesting.
But it was just a bunch of like groaning, but it worked. It helped a lot. So,
well, I got a similar video suggestion on YouTube the other day. It was like Screams of the Dying, Battlefield Aftermath or something. It was very useful for the scene I was trying to write, but it was just an interesting algorithm pull from YouTube.
Yeah. The more specific ambience video title, I think the better it's going to be for a deadline.
I was going to say, I feel like none of our experiences are unique ever once I hear other people's like things too, because I do the same when I write, and then like lighting a candle, like it's this very like structured setup when I'm ready to write and sit down. But then when I read too, it'll be like, yeah, dark medieval chamber library with soft, you know, ancient warbling music or whatever. Yeah, it's funny. I'm glad we all have that experience.
Well, we talked a little bit about your process. So tell us, what are some of your favorite parts about being a writer? It can be about the process or marketing or whatever. And then what are some of your least favorite parts that maybe you wish you didn't have to do all the time? But
I will start with the good. So my favorite parts, I have two, I think. So the character development and what I call it the discovery phase. I don't consider myself a Discovery writer, but it's that, like, for me at least, it's even pre-outline when you just have an idea of who these characters are or what the premise is or what your setting is, and you're just kind of playing around in that sandbox. You're not really, like, building anything yet, but just learning who your characters are, making the playlist, making the Pinterest boards, I really love that, because it's just such, for me at least, such a boundless time in the process. You're not really locked into anything yet, and just anything goes. And my other favorite part is potentially the polar opposite of that. I kind of love the editing process. I think my stories come to life so much more in editing. Because you asked about least favorite too, other than marketing, because I am just not skilled in that area at all. The first draft, maybe it was just second book syndrome, but the book I'm currently working on was so hard for me to get that draft out. I'm a huge perfectionist, and so the concept of the first draft just needs to exist. That's like anathema to me. I don't understand it at all. And I'm like, no, but it has to be readable. It has to be good right now. So I miss editing. Yeah, I'm ready to edit.
I find it very hard to, I know I have to, but I do find it very hard to get into that mindset of just put the words on paper for the first draft and make it pretty later. That's probably the hardest part for me.
I've struggled with that too. I think every writer struggles. And recently I've been catching myself more and more, and maybe it's because I'm writing more frequently, but like just allowing myself to do like brackets, insert, find answer here or whatever, and just keeping going is so helpful. Mm-hmm. And then it makes it easier for me to keep the flow. And then I get excited to go back and find an answer or create an answer to whatever problem I have. It's mostly names, like things I need to come up with that come up that I'm like, oh, I thought I had a name for this, and I absolutely don't. But it's interesting. I wonder how much of that is like somewhat of a lie. Like I understand the concept that like you need to be able to have a draft in order to create a book and like try. But I think there's something to be said about like making your first draft as good as possible, like as good as you can, because then, I don't know, maybe that cuts down on work later down the line instead of having to go back and rework and rewrite. So I don't know. I think there's something to be said about like being very specific and critical with your first draft, not mm-hmm. in a way that is detrimental to your process, but just like it's good when it comes out. It's readable.
Yeah, I think that's definitely part of the reason I have such a hard time with first drafts, because like you said, I'm very much keeping in mind, I'm going to be doing, you know, 3, 4, 5 more passes of this book before it mm-hmm. gets published. I want to not completely hate myself while I'm doing that. So I want to make this first draft as good as I can with the time and resources I have currently. I don't know.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's definitely on my mind.
All right. All right. Next question. Let me see. I think we're in the same spot, Brandon. So this is good. Yeah. You've mentioned who you look for or look to in terms of inspiration, but are there any other artists? It doesn't have to be just authors that you look to for inspo, or like what kind of imbues itself more in your novels outside of what you already talked about?
Mm-hmm. There's, so if anyone... If anyone follows me on TikTok, you know I'm obsessed with Sleep Token. They are hugely, hugely influential in my creative process. I have, I'm like looking at a keychain I went to their show in Greensboro and just have like this keychain on my desk that I got given. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of the themes that are explored in their lyrics of like devotion and obsession and the search for redemption, and also just the music itself, I think, is great. And now I can't find the words for it, but the themes in their music, they're just ones that have always really fascinated me and that I tend to want to explore in a lot of my own work as well. Like, when does like love or devotion turn toxic? When does that turn into something that hurts rather than helps you? And their whole lore is just interesting. It's, because so little of their lore is like official on the part of the band, and so much of it is fan made, they give you just enough to stoke that creative fire and get your brain turning in these very Elden Ring epic fantasy looking kind of ways with a lot of the graphics and promotional material they've used for their most recent album. So Sleep Token's a big one for me. Bastille, another music artist who I love, big on storytelling as well. I tend to like music artists who want to tell stories, can create very cinematic, either looking feels counterintuitive when we're talking about music, but their production invokes a certain feeling, a certain scene. I love when I can just turn on a song and close my eyes and just like picture what's happening. Like it's a movie. Yeah. So that's big. Music is just big for me in general. Can I talk about like other multimedia?
Yeah, things? Absolutely. Whatever inspires you.
Yeah, whatever.
There's a lot.
Give us everything.
Okay. Because I can, when I get really excited about stuff, I can talk a lot. So just like, please tell me.
It's all you, girl. This is your interview. You talk about what you want to talk about.
If there's somewhere to talk about a lot about something, it's a long form podcast, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm
still like TikTok, Instagram, real brain. Right. You have to hook it out in like 3 minutes or something.
True.
My husband and I have been playing a ton of Baldur's Gate 3 lately. So that's been that one. And then Larian Studios also put out this other game a few years ago, Divinity Original Sin 2, that it's like, oh, that walked so Baldur's Gate 3 could run, if to borrow that kind of phrasing. But the open world, like RPG, I really love that, getting to explore the particular like character, almost archetypes that Baldur's Gate 3 puts out for you has been really interesting for me to think about in relation to my own work. I have also, there's a short story I wrote in my creative writing theory class that I, story of my life, I keep trying to find time to revise it and submit it to journals, but it's a like Appalachian Gothic horror piece. Mm-hmm. And that one got inspired by a TikTok I saw, because I had this like, I think he was like a Call of Duty original character, like cosplayer, but there was just the shot of him standing in like a doorway with like antlers, like deer antlers. And so then I wrote a story called Not Deer about an Appalachian cryptid. And I don't know, I've learned to try not to be really choosy about where inspiration comes from. Cause if you told me a few years ago, like, yeah, you're going to write stories based on TikToks, I would have been like, are you serious? But it's inspiration comes very strange places. Whatever I'm studying in school also tends to really influence me. Ash, I think when we were critique partners for like 2 months that one time, there was, I think the project you were looking at for me was my like Baroque art piece. One of my,
yes. Okay. I think so. Yes, yes, yes.
Yes. Forget everything you read about it. It's going to get completely scrapped. Hey, I don't know, at least I can say
I was a part of the early process. Yeah. But yes, I do very much remember this. I
don't know when that's going to happen, one of these days maybe. But one of my minors in undergrad was art history, and I've always been really fascinated by the iconography in art history and how it can at times almost be its own kind of language if you know what to look for. And so there's that. I've studied surrealist art and had a project inspired by that for a while, so you put me in like a college classroom and I just become a sponge, you know, like I'm trying to soak up everything I can. Cause I never know like when the muse is going to strike. So I try to be very, absorby is not a word.
I like absorby though. We can use absorby. Absorbent.
Absorbent.
Yeah. Absorbent. There we go. No, I think that's a great, I don't think we've really touched on this topic too much in the podcast. So maybe it'll be good for like another episode to flesh out more, but we don't really talk too much about our external influences outside of books. So thank you for reminding us that we can be open and inspired by like literally anything we want to. And music is a big one for me too. And I know it is for Brandon, or at least I'm assuming so. I know you've mentioned it before, but I don't know. It's good to also go out of your comfort zone, like go to museums more or like local art galleries and see what you can find to trigger a story idea. Because it just takes just maybe walking through your neighborhood or something like that and just being open. You know, there's a book that, I'm blanking on the name of it. My partner read and wanted me to read and I've been slowly reading it. I'll have to share it with the class later on. But it's essentially just emphasizing how it is important to be open to the universe whenever it's wanting to talk to you and that creative moment strikes. And if it doesn't strike, maybe whispers in your ear and you write it down for an idea for later. So anyway, a great reminder, Jordan, that we need to be open to that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and if you will humor me for a minute, since you mentioned it, I don't get to talk about this game very much on the podcast, but I am going to explain to anyone who's not familiar with Divinity Original Sin 2.
Wait, you've played
I played
it?
The first one. I have. I actually played the first one.
Sorry,
I played the first one.
Mm-hmm.
And if anyone is not like up to date on why this is such a fun game, especially for storytellers, my first experience with this game is playing it with my brother, and we go into this medieval market in the first game, and there's this guy trying to steal a fish because he's hungry. And so in the co-op mode, you play rock, paper, scissors to decide whose choice is going to win out. I told the guy to steal the fish, so he stole it. And then we turned him into the guard that was right around the corner, and he ended up going to the dungeon. And you can find him in the dungeon later. And so like there's just a level of dynamic storytelling to these games that is really hard to find. And it's like everyone's experience is slightly different. Like you might not have done that with the fish thief. Like you may have just, you can kill him if you want to, I guess. Like there's a lot of different things you can do. So the Larian games are really good. And I find to be a big inspiration for me as well, just because of the dynamic level of like interaction and individual storytelling that's there in those games, because it's really hard to find elsewhere.
I think I know exactly what market you're talking about too. Is that one of the ones where the NPCs is like they're yelling about like potatoes or something?
Did you play the first one as well?
I have, yes.
Yeah, I think it's like the first city that you go to. It's been a few years since I played it, but that there's like that core memory of that. Like we encouraged this guy to do this thing and then we turned him in for it. So, yeah, it was really funny though.
Yeah. I would get the voice line just like stuck in my head for days.
Yeah. There is some obnoxious merchant, like trying to get you to buy their, like their vegetables produce or something when you're walking through.
I don't know enough about these, but like I am still on Tumblr and I get a lot of like art and stuff that rolls across my dashboard. That includes that, and also Baldur's Gate has been like a huge like pushed on me. I don't do video games, but it's been really funny to like get lore through osmosis, like through other people and like on Instagram and stuff. It's been pretty funny.
All right. Well, Jordan, to take a little break from like all the process and inspiration questions, I'm sure you see lots of new authors emerging on especially TikTok and Bookstagram and social media. Is there any advice that you have for anyone who's trying to become an author, especially in this new age of like self-publishing and marketing your own work on like Instagram and BookTok and all of that?
I think the biggest one, at least for me, especially recently, has just been finding community, and being also like being okay to wait. I'm trying to think of how to phrase this because I don't want to sound like rude or anything, but finding like the specific part of community that is like your people and who resonate like with you, like not just making friends because you think of the connections they're going to give you. Like, don't be so mercenary about it. I think because writing is such an emotional thing that you kind of want to be patient and find the people who think similarly to you and appreciate some of the similar things, but who can also push you and challenge you. Because it's not only really valuable for like finding critique partners or bouncing your story ideas around, but also for the business side of things. And like, if there's maybe someone who you're considering working with, but your friends might have had a bad experience, or if there's like a book event, I feel like there's been so many of those where authors have just gotten scammed, really. Having friends in the community can also help you kind of know what to avoid, look out for yourself on the business side of things as well.
How did you find those communities for someone who might be starting out? Did you just get that through, you know, eventually following people and then seeing what they were or where they were going, or kind of grapevine? Like, talk us through that.
Yeah. So my first one, my first big one was I got added to, or maybe I joined it. This was years ago. So I'm exactly unsure how, but the Discord Second Cup Writers Cafe, I still am in it. I don't check Discord as much as I used to, but
yeah,
getting to join that and being in voice chat doing writing sprints with people was really awesome to see, like, oh, there are people in this similar like stage of their creative process as I am. And there was one point where I got at just like an acquaintance I had through social media was putting together a big group chat of writers, and it grew to be, I think, like 25 people. It's not super functional anymore, but meeting people I met within that group, I still talk to this day. And don't shy away, I think, from the groups. I know that can be really intimidating, especially in like big and super active ones, but that's been really valuable for me to meet people. And also just being honest about like what inspires you, like to bring it back to Sleep Token, because I feel like I just can't like not talk about them. I have met a lot of really great authors and friends who also just enjoy their music, and we met through bonding over like their music and their storytelling. And so I think even in the more unlikely places where you're maybe entering a space that's not strictly devoted to being writers, but it's just still something you're still passionate about, and you can still bond over it, that's another way to meet people too.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. Do you do any in-person like writing groups? Those are like much more rare nowadays with, you know, thanks to Discord and stuff. But I've been curious, in my own city, there aren't that many. And I'm like, should I start my own like in-person writing group? Yeah. But
I'd love to do an in-person one. The only real in-person workshops I've been able to do have been through my degree. But that's not necessarily people looking to publish in the same way that I'm looking to publish. And in person, I live outside of Charlotte, North Carolina, but in like the South Carolina part of it. So in my particular area, there's not a lot of in-person stuff. It is mostly online, but I don't know. I feel like book clubs are like in-person book clubs are having much more of a resurgence. So fingers crossed for in-person writing groups. I'd love to be part of one.
Yeah. Maybe we can spearhead those and be like the cool ladies. And then Brandon can do one in his area.
I've considered it, but I feel like I've taken on so many projects as it is.
That's true. I'm
trying to limit myself now. It's not tempting.
Yeah.
I definitely would like to. Just seems like a lot of work.
It is. Yeah. And I always like start to do stuff and have like this lofty plan of an idea that coincides with the book. And I have to stop doing that, because it's like, am I subconsciously trying to ruin the writing process for myself? Because I'm just packing so many things into my week every week, you know? Sometimes that can be a deterrent, you know?
Sometimes I think I'm trying to trick myself into thinking I'm working on my book when I'm not actually writing, but I'm doing something like adjacent to it.
Yeah, it counts, kind of, right?
Well, we talked a little bit about what advice you would give to new authors coming into the space. Are there any lessons you've learned from the two books you have out there that are going to affect your publishing process for future books?
Mm-mm. Yes, give yourself much more time than you think you will need. Because I tend to have very lofty publishing timelines for myself. And when I was in crunch time for the Nightmare Novellas, I think the first or second draft, there was one point where I was having to write like 2,000 words a day to get to my self-imposed deadline. And my husband was like, yeah, you're not doing that anymore. Like, I did not see you. I don't want that to happen to you anymore. So you need more time than you think you do. And marketing, for me, marketing matters so much more than I think wanted to admit that it would. I had this very doe-eyed, like dreamily ignorant view of marketing, of like, oh, like my story will speak for itself. Word of mouth will eventually do what word of mouth does, but like word of mouth can't really happen if no one knows you exist in the first place. That's with not being able to market consistently for the last few months because of just like my school schedule and everything, I have seen an impact on it, on just like sales and page reads and things like that. And it's really made me think critically just about like my relationship to marketing, because I grew up in the like beauty guru YouTube generation. And so there was that big push, but like, or at least the way I saw it was that everything you make has to be like unique, and you have to get like this newest thing that everyone's going to be interested in and anticipate what everyone will want. And so then to have to pivot to short form content like Instagram and TikTok, where you're kind of encouraged to post the same thing over and over again, because your stuff is getting out to a different audience each time. That's really hard for me to wrap my mind around, because I can get bored with the same hook very, very quickly, or I'll think it's not describing my book accurately enough, or I'll just think, well, people aren't following me to see the same stuff over and over. But realistically, the people who follow you don't really see your stuff anymore. And I think that's just kind of the nature of the algorithms we're working with now. Mm-hmm. Trying to see it as more of building a brand and building like familiarity, rather than having to be like new and on everybody's For You page kind of thing.
And it is exhausting, even if you aren't like trying to come up with something new, even if you do, which I think is valid, to continue to use like the same hook or a line for a while and then shift. It's just when you're doing it all yourself, it's one, it's time taken away from that creativity, right? You're having to really spend the time creating those videos, editing those videos, and putting them out. Even if it's like 15 seconds on TikTok, that's like, right, like 10 minutes maybe or whatever, to make sure it looks and acts the way it needs to. And it's just, it's an extra weight that I feel like only really self-published / indie publishers have to deal with, right? Like when you go to trad publishing, they kind of handle a good chunk of that for you, but there's almost something to be said about like the grit and the drive of self-publishers, because they have to just continuously, like you said, like build a brand in ways that, you know, I don't know, can be really challenging and really hard and exhausting and time-consuming and then soul-sucking.
And I can get very obsessive about, I don't know, I feel like I don't analyze my metrics very well, but I also get really obsessive over like the numbers and like the view-to-like ratio and stuff. Like one of the things that I have a love-hate relationship with on the edits app, like Meta's version of CapCut, is that it'll give you a 24-hour update of your reels if you make it through edits, and it'll be like, oh, it got this many views with like a whatever percentage skip rate. And I'm like, I mean, it's helpful, but I didn't want to know that right now.
And then you start almost, I don't know if you experienced this, but this was kind of how I was starting to feel on TikTok, but just like, you kind of just get annoyed by it and want to just stop completely. You're just like, nope, I don't even want to touch this. But then there's like just still that pressure to continue to do so.
And then you get punished if you're not consistent. You fall out of the algorithm if you don't post enough. So it's very, I don't know, Brandon, like what you said earlier about finding things to work on that are like adjacent to your book, and you're still writing your book, but not really. Social media really feels like that for me. It's kind of either I can post on social media and y'all can hear about me and know about my book, or I can like actually write a book.
Yeah, I can relate to the obsessing over the analytics, especially with the podcast. Like I'm always, YouTube gives us so many different metrics, like to dislike, average view duration, the demographics of our viewers, like all of that. And so it is definitely hard to find a balance of like stressing too much about those things and adapting too much to the data you're seeing versus like just kind of sticking with the brand you've established and making, you know, hoping that it's going to reach the right people. Cause I think you can adapt to it too much. Like you can see, oh, people aren't watching past this point, so I'm going to change this. And then you change it again the next time you see data that's kind of unfavorable. And I think that's equally dangerous.
Yeah, I agree.
Ash, did you want to take up the next question?
Sure. All right. So what is the best and what is the worst writing advice you have ever received? And I'm excited to hear this from you since you are in school for English. So give us the academic answer. Just kidding. Give us whatever answer you want.
I can talk much more about the best. I might have like one or two pieces of that. Perfect. I'll start with the worst one, because this honestly just kind of infuriates me every time I hear it, the key to increasing tension is just writing shorter sentences. That's not, that's not
interesting.
Let me clarify. I think that can definitely be a part of it, but I have been on panels before where someone gave that as like their only method of increasing tension in a piece. And I was just sitting there like, it's so much more, I think, nuanced than that. There's so much more to consider than just short sentences. I think that's really helpful to convey action and things happening very quickly, of course. And I have also, I mean, I love having shorter, like even fragmented sentences to kind of try to show a character's like one moment.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. To kind of show a character's like thought process maybe breaking down, but I don't think that's something you can rely on heavily or solely for increasing tension. And I just see that get thrown around a lot. Also, M dashes are not a sign that it was written with AI. I just feel the need to say that as an avid M dash lover myself, who has never used generative AI to write anything. You should not be afraid of an M dash. They're our friends.
Yeah.
I might be too good of my friends because there's a couple pages in the Nightmare Novellas where I'm like, someone should have taken that away from me.
I do also love an M dash. I think it's just like, I don't know. So it's also stylistically just something I think is more in right now. It just, I don't know. I think it reads a little bit more. Anyway, I agree with you. I think, go ahead.
No, it looks nice on the page too. That's all I was going to say.
Yeah, I agree. And as for the tension, I really love using fragmented sentences, especially when like a character is working through a thought or like something happens and, you know, they're kind of like, what the hell is going on? But I think it's great that you mentioned this because I think stylistically using those short sentences should be like a punch, like a rare punch that happens. Yes. But if you rely on that exclusively only, it's like, yeah, you're right. It is so much more complex. Mm-hmm. Like, what are the characters doing? How are they conveying their emotion? Like, sentence structure is not the only factor there. So good to stay away from that piece of advice.
Yeah. And then I think the two best pieces, I know I'm cheating a little bit, but there are two. The first one, I'm actually going to regurgitate something I heard Leigh Bardugo say a few weeks ago. I got to see her in conversation with T. Kingfisher for the Six of Crows, like 10th anniversary thing. They came to Charlotte.
Oh, it was so amazing. I'm so jealous.
When I got the tickets, I like screamed a little bit. I was very excited. But one of the things she said was to write the story that you want to write. Because I think someone had specifically asked a question about writing to market. And the way she phrased it was that you should be aware of the market, but you shouldn't let that dictate your creative process or your inspiration. Because if you sit down and you think, okay, I'm going to write a book to trend, writing is a very long process, especially if you go the trad route. By the time that book gets out there, the trend might be over. So it's better to be true to like your own creative process and what you want to do and what you really feel led really to write rather than what you think is going to sell the best.
Yeah, I think that's really important to keep in mind, especially just in these creative fields where the process is so long that chasing those trends is very likely a doomed effort, because by the time, like you said, you're done, there's going to be a whole other trend going around the market that publishers are going to be looking for or that readers are going to be looking for. Mm-hmm. And I feel like every successful writer I've ever heard has echoed that sentiment of write the stories that you want to tell and you'll find the people who want to read them eventually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And also, like, trends are cyclical, right? Like, even if you publish a book and it's maybe not in the trend, I mean, vampires, dragons, fae, like, they're constant kind of iterations of each other, one after the other, at least in the fantasy worlds. I can't speak to any other genre, but, you know, like, you see the 80s, it's just, like, dragons and goblins and evil witches, and then now we're seeing the same kind of topic. So, it's, like, your book will find its niche at the perfect time.
And the other more, this is, you said you wanted something specifically academic, and this is what made me think of this other piece of advice. There's an essay I read by Ben Percy, and it's called Get a Job. And it is just talking about the importance of, especially just in our, you know, capitalistic society that we all live in, we all have to work to make a living somehow. Knowing what your characters do for a living, even if it's not like the focus of the story. I know with the Nightmare Novellas, like they're called nightmare hunters, so clearly their job is important to the story itself. But even if you're not writing like a work-focused narrative, it's really important to know, if they're a working age, what your character does for a living, because it just impacts so much of how we see the world and how we relate to things around us. And that's going to be true for our characters as well. So I think about that essay a lot. So I definitely recommend it. It's from, I think, his book Thrill Me, which is just, if I remember correctly, it's just a bunch of essays on, writing. That's what we're talking about.
No, that's great. We love hearing how other writers have like learned or what pieces of advice they've got. So that's good to know that it has like a place that we can go read about it.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jordan, we know you have both of those books that you shared with us out there in the world receiving reviews and feedback, I'm sure. So tell us a little bit about how you handle, whether it's, you know, after release or during the process, negative feedback or criticism of what you've written.
I have actually so far been very fortunate in the fact that all of the negative feedback or criticism I've gotten has been constructive in nature. If my books have a 1-star review out there, I have not seen it. No one has brought it to my attention. I typically try not to really even look at my Goodreads. When y'all sent me the questions, I was like, oh, it's been a while since I looked at my Goodreads average. And so I just went and looked at the star rating, but I never go any farther than that. But there was one ARC review, and I feel like they need to caveat this with the fact that I'm a huge perfectionist, and it was like a 3.5 star. And it just, her reasoning for 3.5 is that she felt that the Nightmare Novellas, I should have released it later in the series just because it's a prequel. We don't know these characters yet. And that one really got to me because I was like, you know what? That's a very valid criticism.
Yeah.
That's totally fair. And I don't know. I kind of just had to think about it from the point of view of like, I can either let this destroy me, let me, I just lost my train of thought. Sorry. I can either just let it completely upset me, or I can just take it into account for future books, future like prequels I want to write, probably release those once I have more of the books in the actual series out. And I tried to do my best to take it as more of constructive criticism, because I don't believe that I saw this review because I was tagged in it. I feel like I need to clarify that as well. And if you happen to be the reviewer who gave me that, I am thankful for your review. I'm not trying to say you should not have left me that review. Please give me your honest thoughts. I appreciate it, because I do try to take as much negative feedback or criticism as I get as coming from a constructive, intending to be helpful place. And with my grad program, I've done, I think, 5 rounds of writing workshops now. So the majority of critical feedback I've gotten has been given with the intent of making my story better. And just looking at it through that lens has been really, really helpful. I know the ARC reviews and Goodreads reviews are a little different, but even if it is someone saying something, well, I don't know. I feel like I can't really speak. I haven't gotten like a mean review. So I don't know if I can really speak to that as much, but choosing to look at it as something that can be more helpful than hurtful, I would say, is how I deal with it.
Yeah. Well, it's great that it sounds like your experience has been mostly constructive criticism. I know it can be daunting to put your work out there and get feedback, but I've found that every time I have done that, people generally, for the most part, do give constructive feedback. I've never like sent my writing to someone either, and they've been like, this sucks, just give up, and like anything like that. So it's great to hear that you've had a positive experience in that way. And I think approaching all feedback with that mindset of it's coming from a place of improving your craft is just the best way to look at it.
You do also, again, this is from my experience in like the writing workshop, you do kind of get a sense for whose feedback to actually like take to heart and whose feedback not to, because in my workshops, it was always myself and like 14 other people and the professor, and just everyone having different genre focuses or different writing backgrounds or just different intentions for taking the class as well. I think that's another thing, because I know the 1-star reviews are coming in the future. I'm putting something out for the masses to consume. Someone's going to hate it. That's just the nature of how it is. Knowing that when that inevitably comes down the line, it's not something you have to listen to if you don't want to, if that makes sense. Yeah.
Right. That's something I had to learn in my day job, just how to parse through feedback and find the things that are going to be helpful, going to be actionable. And then there's certain things that you can acknowledge, you can see and be like, I see where it's coming from, but I'm not going to act on that because it's whether it's because it's not your vision or there could be a multitude of reasons. But yeah, I think being able to handle criticism and then be able to parse through what's actually helpful are both equally important.
Yeah, I think it's hard not to take it personally sometimes. I think that is like the major lesson, right? Like a one-star review or, oops, did I go? No, I didn't. Sorry, my internet lagged for a second. You know, it's not a declaration that you're a bad person or you're like, you know, a horrible writer. But like you said, if you choose to take it as something like, oh, is this something I'm going to, like, actually, yeah, that's some good insight. And it's not insight I've had before. So I'm going to take that going forward or not, I think is really important.
Well, Jordan, when I was looking at your website, I saw you have this very neat upcoming projects with like their current status section on the books. Yeah. maybe I shouldn't have mentioned that.
Because if you're watching this on YouTube, I'm sure you saw the face I just made. I have not updated my website in a minute. But the part you're talking about should be up to date. Let me pull up my website as well so I can fact check that.
Real-time check-in. I love it.
I think my events page needs to be updated, so maybe just don't look too closely at that.
Okay. Well, yeah, I was mostly just using that to segue into...
I know, I'm sorry.
Tell us. It's okay.
No, it's okay.
To get an idea of your upcoming projects and what you're currently working on.
Let's see. What do I have on there? You're well, I'm pulling this up. I actually just submitted my next book to my editor. That went to my editor 2 weeks ago. And so I am very excited about that one. It is the first book of the Ruby's Vet Saga, first book proper, because if you look at the Nightmare Novellas, it has up here a piece of the Ruby's Vet Saga. So this is like book one half. And book one proper is with my editor right now. So in that one, we've got... Huh?
I said that's exciting.
Oh, thank you. So in that book, it has these two academic rivals. They are sent to chronicle a developing war. You kind of see it get started in the Nightmare Novellas, but the kingdom that these two women live in makes an alliance with one of the active parties in the war, so they get kind of unwillingly brought into it. And so they are told, hey, you're going to go chronicle this, just so we have a history of it for our own records. And on the way there, they find out that the naval vessel that was meant to transport them to this kingdom whose war they will be chronicling is actually a disguised pirate ship. And so things kind of fall apart from there. I'm having to plant the seeds for, again, potentially five books. As of right now, it's planned to be five books and maybe another prequel as well, because I had another idea for another story to tell before this. But yes, it is right now. The plan is that this conflict that these two women find themselves embroiled in is going to expand across the realm, across these five books. We're going to get things escalated to a divine level as well. And there again, is this too spoilery for me to say? In the pantheon I created, there's six gods. And so each one of those gods plus another entity is going to select a champion. And so like the champions are going to get brought into it too. And that's just the rollout, because I know who most of them are right now. The rollout of who those champions will be, I'm very excited for. And again, some of it is kind of getting Easter egged in here, but some of it will still be new because they're just simply characters that you haven't met yet in the Nightmare Novellas who you will meet in this next book. I haven't announced the title yet. I'm planning to do that in November right now. I'm just calling it RS1 or Ruby's Vet Saga 1.
Very cool. Well, it sounds like if anyone does pick up the Nightmare Novellas, they have a lot to look forward to. So that's always great to hear. We do have a question from Mandy in the chat. She said, how did you decide on an editor? Did you just go through the communities that you were active in, or did you look elsewhere?
Oh, that's a great question. So my editor, I had actually known her prior to searching for an editor. We were published in an anthology together because she writes as well. Out of the Cauldron was the name of the anthology. And so I knew from the big group chat all of the authors were put in that she was an editor as well. And then when I took English 600, which is the introduction to the graduate studies program that I'm taking, one of our assignments was to interview someone who has an English degree because our advisor wanted us to see, you know, the career options for somebody with the degree we're putting all this time into getting. And so I reached out to her and asked if I could interview her because editing is something I'm interested in pursuing as well when I get my degree. And so I had that basis of knowing her through the anthology. And then again, in that kind of academic, kind of professional capacity. So when it was time for me to start looking for editors, I reached out to her and asked for her availability. And so now I'm working with someone on her team and I'm really excited about it.
Very cool.
Very cool.
Ash, I will let you go ahead and ask this last fun question we have here on the doc.
All right, sounds good. I am going to try and guess your answer, but we'll see if I'm right. Okay. If there was one book you could read again for the first time, what would it be?
Mm-hmm. Did it
come through? No, nope. Yeah. Okay, let me ask it again.
No, it did. I thought you said you wanted to try and guess what I was going to say.
Oh, no. I'm going to keep it in my head and I'm going to see if I'm right. Sorry. I should have clarified.
No, you're fine. This one was probably, like, out of the questions y'all sent me beforehand, this one was really hard. I have all my bookshelves over here against this wall and I stared at them for like 5 minutes trying to figure out what I wanted to say. Because all of the books that I like to reread, I want to reread them like having the story knowledge that I already have. Like The Picture of Dorian Gray is one of my favorite books, but I would not want to read that one again for the first time because every time I read it, I do a read through like every 2 or 3 years. Every time I read it, I just get something new about it. So yeah, that was just my thought process in trying to answer this question, but I was able to narrow it down to 2, I think. They're very different. The first one is The Undertaking of Heart and Mercy by Megan Bannon. And the second one is Needful Things by Stephen King. And The Undertaking of Heart and Mercy is like romantasy, essentially. It's, I have to like look at it to remember what it's about. It's like enemies to lovers. I thought the world building was just so fun. It strikes this difference between macabre and whimsical because Mercy, one of the characters, is an undertaker, and getting to see this fantasy world's like interaction with their death customs was really, really fascinating. And just the way she had to prepare all the bodies and how these rites were performed, I thought was really fascinating. But the setting, the world building itself, it's like a West, like it feels very like cowboy Wild West kind of inspired. That's the vibe I got from it. And it was just, it's such a fun world to just fall into. I would love to do that again. But Needful Things, you know, it's Stephen King. It's horror. It's very dark. But that, I think that's the one that they say is the last Castle Rock novel, which is his fictional, like, main town. I go through a Stephen King phase every, like, 4 or 5 years. This one just, because his books are just really easy for me to audiobook because, like, if I audiobook something, I have to be okay with, like, missing certain things in it. If I'm, like, working or something, Lab Vona was an exception to that rule because I was locked in. But with Needful Things, it's this basically mysterious man comes to Castle Rock and opens a curio store called Needful Things. And in it, you'll go in there and you'll find, like, the thing you never knew you wanted, but it's the perfect thing for you. And because I think the first person he makes a sale to is like a teenage boy, and he has this baseball card that this boy has really, really wanted. But then he's inevitably, the question of price comes up, and the little boy's kind of like, well, I don't have the money for it. It's a really rare card. Like, surely you would want more money than I have. And the proprietor says, well, I'll give you this really great deal on it, but in exchange, you have to play a trick on someone else in town. And so he's just doing that and slowly turning all the townspeople of Castle Rock against each other while playing on these desires. And some people want the same thing. And it's like, okay, well, will you one up this other person to get it more? And I thought it was just, I know Stephen King, I have a lot of issues with his storytelling as well. But this story in particular, I just thought like the weaponization of desire was so fascinating. And I'd love to, it all comes together in a very messy, fascinating kind of way. So I'd love to just forget that one and read it again.
That's a very interesting premise. I haven't heard of that work of his, so I'll have to check that one out because you've got me intrigued.
Yeah, it sounds so interesting.
Yeah, I don't think it's one of the better known ones. I think, where is it on my shelf? Yeah, because I think it's like the fifth Castle Rock one, but I think Castle Rock is, I think that's where Cujo, I don't know. I haven't read a ton of his like classic ones. I tried to stay away from like the Cujo, the Carrie, and
yeah.
I wanted to read like his lesser known stuff. Mm.
Well, now is going to be the time where I start to open it up to the chat if there's any questions from anyone in the audience. So I'll keep an eye on that and let you know any that come in. But in the meantime, do you have any closing thoughts or maybe any topics we didn't get to touch on that you'd want to chat about real quick? Whether it's, you know, about writing or about Divinity Original Sin 2.
I was going to say, I don't want to ask you about Divinity because have you played the second one?
I've played the second one. I did not finish the second one yet. I think I only got to the end of Act 1. I left Fort Joy, but I never got further than that. It's I still need to play it.
That one is... There's a particular mechanic in Divinity 1 that they did not carry over into Divinity 2. I can't remember what it is. It's something to do, I think, with like resurrecting fallen party members or something like that. But I think the storytelling in Divinity 2 is far superior to Divinity 1. Because I think Divinity 2, I played it once through with my husband, and then I did a solo run, and then we were going to do another co-op run, but then we bought Baldur's Gate 3 and we haven't touched it since.
Yeah.
But I absolutely recommend that one all the way through. Yeah, that's really, really good.
Yeah, I've finished the rest of those three Larian games, Divinity 1 and then Baldur's Gate 3, so next up on the list. Sorry for the background noise.
No, you're good.
They're racing down the street. Mandy, buy the game if you haven't yet. It's really good. And it usually goes on sale for pretty cheap, so definitely check it out. We do have a question from Mandy. She says, are markets worth it for book sales and marketing? So I think she's referencing like physical in-person markets.
I will say
she says that's a question that she has.
Okay. I will say a resounding yes. I have actually done my best sales through in-person markets. I've done quite a few. So like I said, I live in South Carolina. I've done a couple in the Carolinas. I have gone out to Arizona as well. There was one I did out in like the Phoenix Mesa area this past May. I'm going to Savannah this weekend actually for an in-person market. And it's really, as someone who struggles with online marketing and who likes to talk, being able to like speak with someone face to face about my book has been really great, because then they can just ask questions about it, you know, much more tailored things. Like I'll get asked a lot, like, is there spice in it? And I'm able to answer that for them instead of them having to read it and find out for themselves. And even if they don't buy anything, I still just love talking with readers and seeing what people are curious about and what they're reading right now. And so even if they don't end up making a purchase, I think the networking is still great. And it's very affirming to see how supportive at least people around the Carolinas have been, specifically of indie authors, because everyone's really excited about like, oh my gosh, she wrote a book. That's so cool. And I know online, I think a lot of talk around the indie industry and self-publishing industry is that people kind of look down on it. Thankfully, in person, that has not really been my experience at all, which is really, really great.
Yeah, that's great to hear.
That's awesome.
That's always something that's been intimidating to me, but I understand like the value of going out and connecting with people, because there's that level of personal in-person connection that you can have with someone that you can't have through a 15-second TikTok trying to sell them your book.
It definitely Sorry.
I was just going to say, it's great to hear that your perception with that has been positive.
Yeah, it definitely, I was terrified for my first few. It's very helpful that my husband goes with me. And so mm-hmm. we kind of joke that he's my carnival barker because he's a music teacher. And so he's very loud when he talks. But having someone there like as moral support, so I'm not doing it completely alone, is really helpful. But it's also just made, it's made my confidence grow in talking about it just online as well. Mm-hmm. When I have time to sit down and make like a talking head TikTok or a reel or something like that, because I've given people the pitch so many times in person, I'm like, oh, it's just me and my phone. And when I'm recording myself, I can start over if I mess up. So mm-hmm. it really helps in all areas, I think, to talk about your book in person.
We do actually have another question in chat. This one comes from Mike. He says, do you plan to have any hardback books?
Oh, I would love to. That, yeah, eventually I would like to. It's something I need to research much more, because with mm-hmm. the Nightmare Novellas and Breathing Ice Like Fire, I was really just trying to learn the ropes the first time. But with this next yeah. book, I would love to have a hardback.
Do you publish through, I know this wasn't a question in the chat, but do you go through KDP or Ingram for your books, or another party that I'm not?
No, I go through Ingram.
Okay.
The size, I'm a little, I have like a customer service ticket out right now, so I'm a little okay. Ingram, but my paperbacks are through Ingram, but my book, the ebook, is through KDP because I have them on KDP.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's all the questions we have in chat. Ash, did you have anything you wanted to touch on before we get ready to sign off?
I don't think so. I think you answered everything, and I'm excited to continue to read everything you put out, Jordan. It's always great to talk to you, and hopefully we can have you on next time you publish something.
Yeah, I'd love to. So summer 2026 is what I'm aiming for. So.
All right.
Hell
fingers
yeah.
crossed. We'll hold the slot for you. All right. Well, thanks, Jordan, so much for taking the time to talk to us about writing and books yes. and video games, because I don't get to talk about those much on the podcast.
So,
you don't.
If you ever do a video game episode, I can talk a lot about those three games in particular.
Perfect. We'll have to find some guest hosts.
We'll make it happen.
You know where
All
to
right,
find me.
Well, thanks to everyone as well in the chat for your engagement during this episode. It's been great seeing all your comments come in, and we will see you all in the next episode of Quill and Queer.
Bye, y'all. See you guys later.